this figured out, I'm going to bring in Mr. Blaber. Pete, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Good. I can, Todd. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Outstanding. You look great. I'm all rested from Spain, you know, just out on the beach.
Yeah. It was the beach was a small part of it, but, you know, to our viewers, we tried this last week. I was on the ground in Europe in the Black Sea area, where I met with what I'll just call guys on the ground, which included many citizens of the countries we'll talk about today, and more about that in episodes in the coming weeks. Before we get going, what I want to share with our viewers is something that didn't happen in Europe. It happened once I arrived back in the U.S., and that was just this feeling of overwhelming gratitude that I felt for the fact that I live in this great and beautiful country that we call America. And if anyone needs to be reminded of just how good we have it and why this country is so worth fighting for, just do a little bit of world travel. And you'll feel the same thing that I felt when I stepped off the plane. And that's, I'm proud to be an American and grateful for our freedoms, which is why we do this show, because they've been under attack for the last 16 years and most intensely over these last two. So very grateful to be back. I'm tech savvy to our viewers, but something happened to my computer when I got to the Black Sea area. Probably saw who I was, and we were able to work through that. But it just shows you at any time you can be the victim of what we describe the censorship industrial complex that sits front and center over in Ukraine.
Yeah, when you're dealing with a state actor that has a lot of resources, it's very hard to defend against that. I mean, we've experienced it for years, and it's still going on. So, and a lot of times you don't know what they're doing. You find out later, and it's just, you know, they go in and flick a switch somewhere, and you don't know where it is, and it's interesting. But tell us about your trip. What did you learn? Or do you want to go or run first? It's up to you.
Yeah, just, you know, very quickly, a lot of good information about Ukraine, which we'll talk about in a bit, and the censorship industrial complex, how the people of Ukraine really have no voice, and that we're in the middle of this massive, information op. Which we'll talk about when we get to Ukraine. I want to talk about Iran first, but the same thing is happening in Iran. It's the same playbook. As you'll hear, I'll talk about some of the people, who have been the loudest voices against what's happening in Iran. They're the same people who are cheering on the Iran or the Ukraine war and with no care about, again, the people that live there, or the future, or America and the American people and American soldiers and military personnel in general. It's despicable, but that's why we do this show. We want to call it out and show living proof of it.
You know, I see a huge operation even this morning. They're still trying to get Pahlavi in there, which is the Shah's son. He has really no support, and he's saying, we got millions on the ground. That's just not true. Somebody really wants him in power. Obviously, he's an actor like Zelensky or some of these others. It's fascinating to watch the info op, though. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another pattern recognition is what I teach. It's yep. What common sense is, and the common pattern between the Iran operation and the Ukraine war is the same. At its base, and most apparent of all, is if you think of all the coverage from the globalist media on both Ukraine and Iran, you realize the same thing is present. There's no coverage of the people who live there. Mm-hmm. So we have highlighted, and we will next week, some more videos, ground videos from Iran. Those have become harder and harder to sneak out. But it's the same thing with Ukraine. The people have no voice. whether it's mainstream media or the political pundits, they never mention the people. They never mention how does what happening on the ground affect those people. And, you know, very apparent, we've showed the videos, Ukraine has to beat people. People rise up to fight those that are trying to forcefully conscript them. But it's the same thing in Iran. And we should never forget the people. And I think one of the things that'll come out very soon about the Iran situation is that the people have to choose the new leadership. And how it's going to happen in Iran. Even if somehow we had taken out all the leaders, we would have been left with a dilemma. Who is going to fill in the vacuum? And it's never in the history of warfare, it's never worked that an outside element picks the new regime leadership. The Iranian people have to pick it. The Ukrainian people have to pick their new leadership. We can't do it for them. Because inevitably it ends up being the wrong person who does not have the support of the people. So to me, that's the most telling pattern between the two. But we'll talk a lot more about that in a moment when we talk about each situation separately.
I just want to highlight President Trump. You know, I've been reporting on. As you say, the people on the ground, the Iranian resistance on the ground. But President Trump, and I've been doing that for 10 years, came out and posted an interview of them, which I found fascinating, which means he's looking at other options on the ground and maybe more toward what you are talking about, Pete, which is, you know, letting the people decide. So I found that just fascinating.
Yeah, well, from the beginning, this administration's done the right thing. They've been protecting their sources in Iran. So if you remember in the first few weeks when President Trump was saying, hey, we're negotiating right now, they're at the table. Well, a big part of that negotiation was with the underground, the Iranian underground. And he has built on the trust that they've established with them by not outing them for political points. He's stayed steady, and you have to do that. The timing, you know, one of the things that these critics and pundits have taken away from not just President Trump and the administration, but from the Iranian people is time. You know, time is the fuel that powers the process of creating options. And if you don't have time, you can't create options. So from every front, President Trump's ability to use time, the U.S.'s ability to use time has been taken away by these pundits and these outside interests. And inevitably, they're taking away the Iranian people's ability to achieve freedom, which is should be the real goal that everyone talks about with the Iran situation.
I just before we move on, I just want to highlight my book, Paying the Price, The Untold Story of the Iranian Resistance. You can find it anywhere. It's really an eye-opening as to who these people are, because most people, I was unaware of them, and I was pretty world-traveled, and so I spent a lot of time with them, and I think the book is informative. Back to you.
I agree. I read it again on my plane ride over there, and
really?
It's a fantastic book. I'd second your recommendation, and we need more of that. We need reporting to focus on the Iranian people to give them a voice. And once we get to Ukraine, we'll talk about that also.
Well, let's talk real quick about the geopolitical implications of this deal. It seems to me that things are moving forward. The oil's flowing. There's still some negotiation with Oman and Iran and, you know, what it's actually going to look like. But in my opinion, we need the oil flowing. We need the fertilizer flowing. Because the downside of that not happening is famine in certain, you know, maybe in Africa. There's food pressures in Europe. There's energy pressures in Europe. If we want to save Europe, we have to get their energy situation solved. So, you know, there's a lot riding on this. What do you think is happening in the Gulf right now?
Yeah, so despite the disinformation and the propaganda, to me, the outcome has been a massive win for not just President Trump, but for the Middle East specifically and the rest of the world in general. the real damage of the propaganda is it prevents the objective observer from seeing this bigger picture of events. And no matter how much those leak out, the propagandists continue outright denying any of the positives. And the reason for that is because the same thing we see domestically. Mm-hmm. They have one strategy, that Trump loses, that somehow this shines a negative light on President Trump. They never think in terms of the of our country and of Western and freedom-loving people's interests in general. And it's actually, you know, borderline childish. What's happened now is these propagandists and political pundits, it's all about the fact that they don't want to be proven wrong. They made the cardinal error in the beginning of the operation of making predictions, apocalyptic predictions, that proved false during the five-week war. So instead of saying, wait, you know, wait, I admit now I was wrong, they simply shifted fire onto the negotiation process. And now no matter what comes out of the negotiation process, and I think J.D. Vance is a real hero of those negotiations, they continue to focus on casting negative shade on every aspect of it. And before we go on there, you know, it's important to point out who these individuals are. There's a number of subversive groups in the U.S. and in the Western world in general who are vying to control the narrative. And J.D. Rucker put out a great article about this. And he listed it into four categories. I'll use three of those and then one of my own. And the first is, you know, the same group who has been cheering on the death and destruction in Ukraine. That's the neocon warmongers, people like John Bolton, Lindsey Graham, and Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. And when you say those names out loud, you just scratch your head and say, how did they even still have a voice? Why is anyone listening to them? Well, because the left has taken a liking to all three of these former enemies of the left and given them a voice. They're all part of the Atlantic Council crowd. And, you know, the thing about the Iran op is all of these guys have long wanted and espoused for the total annihilation of Iran. And none of them care about how many American lives are put at risk to achieve that goal. Because now they're angry that the peace deal, because it sabotages further their agenda for total regime change and U.S. occupation of the region. The second group is the one you hear about most often, and that's the Israeli lobby. Like the neocons, and in many cases part of the neocon cabal, the Israeli lobby wants a ground invasion and total regime change. They have long held up that the threat of a nuclear Iran is the rationale for U.S. ground deployment. And, you know, just like we say with Ukraine, I'll say this about Israel. This is a lobby group. It's not the Israeli people. So people who have made this bizarre shift from what the Israeli lobby group does and says to the Israeli people and Jewish people in general, either have an anti-Semitic belief that stays hidden in their you know, inside their own brains and motivates them to say the things they say, but it's showing this incredibly short-sighted view of what the Israeli lobby
is. Every day, your data is being tracked, collected, and sold, often without you even realizing it. Big tech companies control your devices, your apps, and the information you share. From your messages to your browsing habits, everything is being monitored and stored. Over time, we've traded privacy for convenience, and most people don't even question it. But what if you could take that control back? That's where Mark 37 comes in. Mark 37 provides privacy-focused phones, laptops, and tablets designed to give you full control over your digital life. With secure systems, expert support, and simple tools, they make it easier to step away from constant tracking and data collection. Because privacy isn't just a feature, it's a fundamental choice. It's about protecting your data, your freedom, and your future. Take back control of your digital life with Mark 37.
Just like the lobbying groups we have in America, the food lobby, the pharma lobby, that's not the American people. That's a lobbying group. And in that same tone, I'd mention on Israel, Israel has a right to defend itself. And in this case, in Iran, they had some of the most accurate intelligence that has ever been available in the beginning of any military operation, which that's not a theory, that's empirical fact. And that's why 48 Iranian leaders, the first two tiers of the Iranian totalitarian regime's leadership, were taken out in the first 48 hours. So, you know, the upshot of that is, you know, it's not America's job to do the fighting for them. And if we are fighting over there, it's because American national interests are at stake. The third group is the political left. And again, no surprise here. It's Trump derangement syndrome on steroids. They just want a quagmire in Iran because they think it will jumpstart their own midterm election campaigns, which are already severely taking a hit, not from Iran, but from their policies in general. And the most despicable part of that is this alliance, this under the table alliance they've now established with Islamic interests as another way to tear down Western civilization. So the leftists see any positive news, any win for Trump, as a threat to their return to power. And the final group is one that I mentioned that, you know, I think is important to call out. And that's the political pundits on the left and right. You know, you call them, there's podcasters. Mm-hmm. Some call it the ex-Fox News podcasters. You know, what I've observed, and I think you'll agree with this, Todd, same thing. They're operating off their emotional brain. They tried to make a prediction in the beginning about what would happen in the war. And that prediction was this will lead to World War III. Hormuz closure will crash the global economy. And Trump is going to deploy tens of thousands of ground troops and with thousands of casualties, as well as numerous U.S. naval ships destroyed by hypersonic missiles. Mm-hmm. And like I said, none of that has happened. And they were all wrong. But what, instead of correcting themselves, going on camera and saying, hey, look, I didn't have the big picture when I made my prediction. I didn't know about the intelligence. I didn't know about what Iran was really doing. They've just shifted fire onto the negotiation process. So you asked about, you know, what are some of the positives? And there are a number of them, and they may seem subtle, but once you say them out loud and call attention to them, you realize they're quite significant. The first, you know, in order of chronological order, was just forcing Iran and its regime to the negotiating table without deploying the ground invasion and potentially saving thousands of U.S. lives. The second was the knowledge that this blockade of the blockade has taken Iran's biggest coercive threat to not just the Middle East, but to the West in general, away from them. And that's the closing of the Strait of Hormuz. And what did that was the blockade of the blockade, shifting from opening the Strait of Hormuz to closing Iranian ports. That was the genius move that really was a knockout blow to Iran. And again, shifting fire to the negotiation process, which all of these pundits not long ago were saying it was impossible. They were saying Iran will fight to the last man. They'll never go to the negotiating table. You've underestimated them. But that has proven not to be true. I already mentioned two levels of Iranian leadership no longer exist. And this was these were the individuals responsible for all the crimes against humanity in Iran, as well as the terrorist strikes across the whole Middle East. And for that reason alone, that's why you had such unity among Middle Eastern countries for the first time ever. Middle Eastern Arab countries actually working with not just the U.S., but the Israeli military to achieve their common goal. And that should also have told a lot of people about just how serious this threat was from Iran. When every other country, every other Arab country in the Middle East was against Iran, still is against Iran, you know that this isn't made up intelligence. This isn't a hypothetical threat. We talked about the Strait of Hormuz. It's wide open. And then the next thing is Iran's 60% enriched nuclear materials are buried now under a mountain range. And their weapons program, their nuclear military industrial complex has been destroyed. So a lot of small positives. The final one I'll talk about is the end of the OPEC oil cartel. Mm-hmm. UAE announced its exit first, which means all the other members will have to exit in order to compete with UAE's increased oil production. And this means a lot more oil on the market and much lower prices in the long run. Seeing the big picture, seeing the future as it unfolds in front of you, instead of taking an emotional view locked into the context of the moment when these individuals took it. And of course, the final thing I have to mention is the Iranian people are closer to freedom. They now have some hope. They saw what just happened. They know who's died. We showed on our program, I think 3 weeks ago, those initial smuggled out mm-hmm. iPhone, videos of everyone in Iran rising up, cheering when they heard Khomeini was killed. That's what we should be focused on, the Iranian people. Now, what's the controversy with the negotiation? Well, the controversy is that now they're saying that, Iran has won at the negotiating table, but it's important to say out loud what Iran actually won from this. And first and foremost, I just read an article on it this morning before the show, a massive lie that Iran is getting a $300 billion payout from the U.S. to sign this peace negotiation. This is not only false, but a deliberate misrepresentation of the fact. There is no $300 billion right now. This is a negotiating step, very savvy negotiating step, and it's an investment fund. It's not from the U.S. coffers. Never has there been any chance that this was going to be U.S. taxpayer dollars. The money itself is funded by other Middle Eastern countries and private investors. If it happens, it's nothing more than a carrot for the Iranians.
So the narrative they're pushing out there is that this is Obama's deal plus $300 billion to the Iranians. That's completely
exactly. Funny. Obama himself mentioned it in his part of his library speech. Mm-hmm. But there's no $300 billion. The U.S. never told them we're going to give you $300 billion. It's a fund that hasn't even been created yet. Mm-hmm. But remember, the U.S. has been talking with its Middle Eastern allies the whole time. The majority of the fund will come from them. The next massive lie that is also kind of an offshoot of this, of the Obama deal, was, unfreezing Iranian assets. First and foremost, just like everything else, you got to say it out loud, Iranian assets. So they always have been Iran's money. And just like this insanity of Europe holding Russians' frozen assets hostage, that isn't money they can tap into. That's Russia's money. And this is Iran's money. the fact of the asset on the unfreezing of the assets is this: the U.S. only holds about $2 billion of the total funds. The rest is scattered through dozens of other countries, again, mostly Middle Eastern countries. And you've heard a couple times the UAE talk about, I believe, 12 to 14 billion, but it's spread out through all those countries where Iran's assets have been frozen in. The high oil and gas prices, this was a fear-based tactic that was, also included in that statement was this is going to tube the Republicans in the midterms. To be clear, there has never been any supply shortage from the start of this war on, zero supply shortage. Oil prices rose due to speculation, not fact, market speculation. And of course, people like the oil companies and the airlines were only too happy to take advantage of that and charge higher prices. In the meantime, President Trump did an amazing thing last night. If you read his X page, he sent out a message. He said, prices have plummeted, I think, $30, $35 so far, but there's been no adjustment in American gas prices. And President Trump said, I've already notified the DOJ to begin looking into our oil and gas companies. And if those prices don't come down soon, they're going to be knocking on your door. To me, that's what a president's supposed to do. He's supposed to represent the people, use his powers. Instead of saying, we're going to create a new law that punishes you, he just says it out loud to them. This needs to change immediately, or something drastic will happen that'll force it to change. And then the final thing is the Iranian. That's the purpose, at least, that most of us heard for the beginning of the war. And the U.S. now essentially controls those resources. That's not a threat that we have to think about at this point. So the lessons, I think. Before I end on Iran, there's been some major lessons to talk about that are still unfolding. The first is one of the most despicable. If Iran was successful at anything, it was the exploitation of the globalist / mainstream media and social media. Mm-hmm. And they've used them to spread this disinformation. So never before have we had an enemy. And make no mistake, the Iranian regime has been our enemy for 47 years, but never before have we seen our own mainstream media and the globalist media in general side with them and be used by them as proxies. Trump's political base has remained steady throughout. This should have been an indication, a pattern that many of these political pundits and podcasters should have noted right off the bat. People don't support making America great again because some podcaster supports it. That podcaster's popularity came from the fact that they were saying the same things that the majority of the American people believe in, which is America for Americans, use common sense. And that was not happening, but it is now. So, just kind of to wrap it up, even if you didn't agree with the initiation of the war, you and I talked about that. Mm-hmm. Neither of us did in the beginning, but we had enough savvy, enough experience, historical respect to say, let's take a wait and see attitude. We don't have all the intelligence. I already mentioned that intelligence is not theoretical. It was empirical. Never before have the top two levels of any regime been decapitated in 48 hours of a war. And that's why the Iranian people have hope. Those individuals being gone gives them hope. The fact is Trump is getting everything he wanted out of this deal, and Iran is getting nothing unless they comply. And, you know, this is not pie in the sky. We've seen how mercurial the Iranians are. You know, things could break down at any moment. But if you think about it, Trump has lost nothing. Now he has almost the template for how to go back, do the same thing militarily, strategically, operationally. And we can go right back to applying the same pressure that brought the Iranians to the negotiating table in the first place.
Very well said. I want to just highlight two issues. One, I want to highlight Pahlavi's recent comments, but also I want to talk about the info op a little bit before we go to Ukraine. But this is Pahlavi recently, about 30 seconds.
To be part of the political process?
Well, I'm glad you're asking the question, because it has never been a case for me to run for office or position. But I'm uniquely placed to be an agent of change and transition. There's a trust in me. That's why when on January 8th I make a call, millions of people came out there supporting me.
That is a complete lie. The Iranian people do not want the son of the Shah, who was a dictator who tortured many, to come back to power. They want some kind of representative government. So I just want to say that. He doesn't have millions of supporters. And also, the info op going on, I put this out this morning, and I'll just say ahead of time, I'm thankful for Tucker for having me on Fox Nation a few years back for an hour to talk about ending the Ukraine war and actually what was going on. But there is something happening, and I put this article out this morning. Tucker is running for something, and there's a huge info op going on. I agree with him highlighting a lot of the foreign influence in our government, but he is ignoring some of the other influences. I mean, we have the call to prayer in New York City right now. I mean, he's ignoring the influence of the a lot of the Islamic politicians coming into the country, which I think we should keep this a Christian, you know, oriented country. And there's a huge coordination going on with a lot of other influencers to, again, say that Trump lost and Iran won. And I don't agree with that. We're going to continue to report on that. But it's a lengthy article. You can find this on CDM. All right, you want to talk Ukraine, Pete?
Yeah, and I would just add on that same thing. I've always appreciated Tucker, but you saw, you know, his words ended up boxing him in.
Divorce is tough, but your finances don't have to be. I'm David Cross, and I'm a certified divorce financial analyst practitioner. My job is to help you get a fair financial settlement in your divorce and to guide you to smarter money decisions. Find out how we can help you. U.S. Asset Management. It's your money and your future.
Your government doesn't care about you. That's why you need a medical emergency kit. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, Z-Pak, and antibiotics. Stock them before they block them.
Which, you know, you should know, your words can change and you can get out of the box or the corner you've painted yourself into. But he appears dead set on, you know, not being wrong. That's his goal at this point. And, you know, he said some very inflammatory things about Israeli lobby and Israelis in general. And none of us are for our country just doing whatever, you know, Israel says. And if you've studied President Trump at all, you would never even allow yourself to be fooled into thinking that he would do that. You know, anyone who's worked with him would tell you, you know, once he makes up his mind on facts, you're not going to go in and bribe him. He's unbribable. He's uncajolable. But Tucker did mention, I just saw a clip of it on, I think, Alex Jones' podcast, that he's considering 2028. And I think if you look at what he said in the days prior to that, there's no way I'll support the Republican Party. I think he thinks that just what we talked about, that he's the Make America Great Again movement, that he created it. Instead, what he needs to understand is his popularity was created from his time on Fox News forward by the fact he was just a voice of the Make America Great Again movement. And notice I don't say MAGA, because it oversimplifies what it is. It makes it sound like a political party. It's not. It's common sense. And every country, you can take the A and replace the first letter of every country, has the same movement. You have to be for your group, your home first, or you're never going to survive. And of course, you know, we're about to talk about Ukraine. That's what's happened to Europe. They've become MUGA, make Ukraine great again, instead of make Britain great again, make France great again, make Germany great again. It's a cardinal error. It's an emotional brain error that's easily corrected if you allow it to be. But again, the problem with being with some of these, you know, mega podcasters is they fall into the same trap that people who make millions or billions of dollars can easily fall into. They think it's them, not the people they represent, that got them to that point.
Completely agree. Let's move to Ukraine. We've talked about, well, maybe I haven't with you, but there's been a campaign in Ukraine to counter a lot of the success that Russia's having on the battlefield. And my sources, and maybe you can confirm or deny, are telling me that Konstantinivka, I think is the word, is pretty much surrounded by or infiltrated and controlled by Russian assets at this point, and they're moving. If that happens, the next targets are Slovyansk and some of the other very critical infrastructure in that part of the world. So I think that, as Putin said, the war is about over in Ukraine. So now you're seeing a response from the Ukrainian and the European forces to lash out with long-range strikes into Europe. You're seeing UK build and provide very powerful long-range weapons to Ukraine. And that opens up the whole threat of, you know, Russia striking Europe in response, which could drive bring the U.S. into the war as being a part of NATO with an Article 5 treaty obligation. So this is getting very serious. And in fact, 12 villages were just evacuated along the northern border near Belarus. Zelensky is threatening Belarus. He's threatening Poland. And it's getting pretty, I guess, worrisome. Pete, what say you?
Yeah, great summary. You just took about a third of my update out. And no, it's the facts. And what you're talking about with the Slovyansk region is the last and most important hub for Ukraine in Donbas. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd sum up what I'm about to say with this: desperate men make desperate moves. It's just human nature. And so what you're seeing is this conglomeration of desperate men from Zelensky in Ukraine, desperate, totally desperate, because the people are rising up in Ukraine. They know they're losing the war. This is not a judgmental thing. It's a numbers thing. It's a infrastructure thing. It's a what hope do we have for the future thing. But it's not just the Ukrainians. In consonance with their desperation, these European leaders are also desperate. Their polling is the lowest polling of any heads of state have ever had in Germany, France, and Britain. We saw Starmer just resigned, but apparently the guy who's favored to replace him is even further to the left than Starmer. You know, we always look at motivation before we talk about what they're doing. And what's their motivation? Their motivation is just what we said. The last hub in Donbas is about to fall. Mm-hmm. And with that, Ukraine itself is about to fall. And what does that mean? That means the end of the censorship industrial complex. And in the same way that the left in the U.S. has become completely desperate, because step by step we're dismantling this censorship industrial cheating complex, we should add that, because that's what it was. It was censorship industrial in order to continue the cheating, the color revolutions, the vote swings. You know, I've said it before, I live in California. We just witnessed one of the most egregious, election results that anyone's ever seen. None of it made sense. How they threw the first mayoral election in LA and almost threw the governor's election, but they couldn't. They ran into some problems on the governor race. The biggest one being the overwhelming number of people who voted for Steve Hilton. So, you know, and the result of that is in the last few weeks, we've seen this massive information op taking place, not just in Europe and not just in Ukraine, but in the Western media in general. And hey, you can always tell an information op because it's an echo chamber. Yeah. Ukraine is finally winning the war. Yes. And, you know, there's no denying they've had a couple of successful long-range missile strikes in Russia, but that has done nothing to the forces on the battlefield, absolutely nothing. And while the fact of the matter is on the ground, not only is Russia winning, but it's moving into the end game, as you just talked about, in Donbas, which is the cradle of the war. And we've been reporting on the siege and encirclement of Constantinople for a while and how this fortified bastion was the key for the final assault for Slavyansk, which you also mentioned, the agglomeration in Slavyansk. And it's the last region held by the Ukrainian forces. And if that goes, there's nothing holding them back from going all the way to Kyiv. And Russia is winning, and they're winning with their tried and tested playbook. Russia's forces do not smash head on. We've talked about this in detail. They don't do frontal attacks, but rather they take their time. They flank each conglomeration with multiple prongs. They encircle it, attack the supply lines, and put the defenders in fire pockets, and then incrementally destroy them in the fire pockets. Last month's report citing Ukrainian intelligence claimed Russia's top commanders had convinced Vladimir Putin that they could seize Kramorsk and Slavyansk and the town center of the fortress by the end of the year. And once that happens, pretty much the war is all but over. So you're watching this, this massive information operation continue. The desperate, and just think, desperate men make desperate moves. I've heard all the political pundits, the ex-generals, they're all mad. You just saw a general resigned in the U.S. yesterday. There were multiple reasons for that. He was a big hawk on the Ukraine-Iran war. We mentioned him in multiple episodes in the article I wrote on yes. the debacle of micromanaging the Ukraine war by the U.S. He was one of the micromanagers. But the mainstream media has taken that run with it. Hegseth fires another military hero. He was not a hero.
You're talking about Donahue, right?
Yeah, and in fact, the truth of the matter is, and I just got this from a source yesterday, the reason he's resigning has nothing to do with Hegseth. He's resigning because Hegseth, in his effort to get rid of this massive excess of four-star generals, has simply stated, we need to go back to making the UCOM commander a three-star general. And I can tell you from experience during Bosnia, that command commanded over 200,000 troops. We don't have the current command, it's about 125, I think. 200,000 troops, he was a three-star general. Mm-hmm. So when you tell a four-star general that his job is going to be downgraded to three, some of them can't handle that. And that's the real reason he's quitting. It's not any kind of, philosophical thing. It's not Hegseth saying, get out of here, you're not doing a good job. He's quitting because his command is being downgraded from four stars to three.
Well, we've had a lot of people write on our armedforces.press channel that he was instrumental in the Abbey Gate issue and the withdrawal from Afghanistan, from Kabul. I mean, he forced a war trophy of a small vehicle onto the aircraft and forced off human beings who were not allowed to get out, and should have, and then did it and made several trips and filming himself getting on. I mean, it was, I'm told it was absurd. I wasn't there, but it's kind of very, you may know more, but.
Yeah, it's all true. It's all true. I know guys who were there. All of that is accurate. They're, you know, red hot, pissed off. They have been since then. He was following orders, and that's one of the problems with, you know, making your career based on how many stars you have.
Yeah.
You end up genuflecting to the political elite. And of course, that was the Biden administration. He was taking orders from the very highest level of that administration. And, it, you know, history matters. The problem is you can do whatever you want in the present, but history says you got to live with the results. And he has to live with the decisions he made, you know, in Kabul during the shutdown.
I want to just highlight a few things. One is there is a campaign, and one of our sources has talked about it on another episode, of the Ukrainians using a point system to kill anything in the Donbass area or even Western Russia and Bryansk and that whole area, that they're using these FPV drones to come in and literally hit civilian vehicles, people in cars, people walking, and they get points, and then they'll get more equipment or R&R or whatever if from the Ukrainian government. But this is one example of this. This is a FPV drone taking out a civilian truck in Bryansk. Absolutely no military significance, but here you go. So you can see the drone comes in and kills the driver. And so that's going on all over Russia. That's not a military target. And also, right. Here's another video. You talked about the mobilization. People are desperate to get out from this mobilization, and it's increasing in its ferocity. So one guy put a hang glider and tried to paraglide across the border.
Походу з України. На параплані, бачите, по ньому стріляють.
And they screenshot out. That just shows the desperation, you know, the craziness.
Yeah, and it's disgusting, and it's most disgusting because none of that has any relevance to what's happening on the battlefield. So, you know, and they'll have to live with that, all the way down to the drone operator who did that. Mm-hmm. He'll be, you know, he'll have to live with that. That's how you prevent PTSD. You do the right thing in the context of the moment. You do your best, and you won't be haunted for the rest of your life. Not, you know, equating that to PTSD in general, but that's what happens to these individuals who commit war crimes. They have to live with it. And but the insanity of it has zero effect on the battlefield. And anyone who thinks that attacking civilian targets in Russia is going to cause the Russian people to rise up, which was the initial strategy made by the Obama administration non-elected officials and the Biden administration non-elected officials, it's fallacy. You're just hardening the resolve of the Russian people and showing them that this is NATO. It's them against NATO. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm glad President Trump has said already he's now shifting his focus back to the Ukraine war, because he's the only one who can end the insanity and stop the senseless killing that's going on only in the name of propaganda. You know, they show that video is out because they showed that video is here we are attacking inside Russia. Mm-hmm. Same thing that happened with that dorm room where they killed, I think, 17 students.
Yeah.
Why did you do that? What, and do you really think that's going to bring the Russian people to their knees? No, you kill students, you're just hardening their ire, hardening their resolve, and making it worse off for yourself in the end.
I want to highlight real quick our first website we started back in 2015, tsarism.com, and the name comes from the old Russian Tsarist Empire. It has nothing to do, it's not pro-Russian, pro-Ukrainian, it's pro-truth and from the region. And so we cover from literally Central Europe, from Poland, which was part of the Tsarist Empire, all the way to San Francisco, So that whole region, there's a Fort Rus in San Francisco you can go to. But if you're interested in Russian culture, history, not Russian, but Eastern European culture, history, et cetera, I was living in Ukraine at the time we started this. So it's just put it in your daily scan. All right, back to you, Pete.
That's it. That's all I have.
Okay, so long show today. Thank you for hanging with us. We'll be back tomorrow. I've got Ivan Raiklin coming on tomorrow morning. Should be an interesting, edgy interview, to say the least. So, Pete, thank you. We'll see you next time.
Sounds good, Todd. Take care.